So you survived the weekend?
Yeah,
really? Great. You like how it helped you? Yeah, you got a little refreshed.
I know. Something all weekend. Always say things you don't want to do.
Jackie? Is it time? All right, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Jackie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Before we say the Serenity Prayer together, please let's share a moment of silence while we think about why we are here. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Is there anyone here tonight who has never attended an AA meeting before? I just want to get to know you. Anyone? Okay, do we have any visitors from out of town or from other groups? Hey, welcome. Any other visitors? Okay. Will you please check your cell phones at this time and make sure they're turned off or on silent so we don't disturb the speaker? This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help others to achieve sobriety. We have no dues or fees, but we do have self-supporting baskets, which will be passed while three friends come up to read how it works, the 12 traditions, and the promises. If you can contribute whatever you can to help our group to meet rising expenses, it would be greatly appreciated. The baskets will be passed during the reading of our 12 traditions. Marissa will get us started with how it works.
Hi, I'm Marissa, and I'm an alcoholic. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures have availed us nothing. We stood at a turning point. We asked for his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and become willing to make amends with them all. 9, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except to do so when would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory when we were wrong and promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us explained, what in order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our lives, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and that God could and would if he were sought.
Thanks. Hi, my name is Tony, and I'm an alcoholic. These are the 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purposes, there's but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, since the AA name ought never to be drawn into public controversy. And 11, our public relations policy is based upon attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And then 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
My name is Kara. I'm an alcoholic. Yes. These are the promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
Okay, thank you to everyone who read. We have one more reading. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, speakers with an S, desperately in need, we'll hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, we have a special treat. Charmin is an awesome woman that I met recently. I'm really looking forward to hearing her story tonight. She runs a sober living house over in Sandy Springs, and I had the opportunity to meet her when I went over there to do a panel recently, but I feel like I know her even more than that just from sponsoring one of her girls over there. I hear wonderful things about Charmin all the time, and I know she works a really strong program and is obviously heavily involved in service work, and I'm just excited to introduce Charmin to y'all tonight.
Hey, everybody. My name's Charmin, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a little nervous. Every time I tell my story, I get nervous, and it occurred to me several years ago when I told my story that the reason that I get nervous is because my ego wants to make sure everybody still likes me when I'm finished talking. I really want to thank you guys for having me out, and especially to Tim for the invitation. I'm glad to be here. I hope, truly hope, that anything that I share, at least one of you guys can identify with it. I'm the middle kid of a very dysfunctional family. I have an older brother, a younger sister, and my sister is in recovery, and my brother is not one of us. My parents went through an incredibly ugly divorce when I was 13, and there was a tremendous amount of emotional abuse, physical violence that I witnessed, and it was just a very difficult time for my family. They divorced. I lived in Lithonia and Conyers, and when they divorced, my mom moved us to Marietta, and I was not prepared for what it meant to attend Wheeler High School. Coming from the country. And, you know, I always felt like I didn't quite fit in. I kind of fit in. I mean, I had friends. I was active. I played softball. But I just was never really in. And certainly when I moved to Marietta and started attending Wheeler High School, I knew that I did not fit in. They wore Jordache jeans and Izod shirts, and I wore Levi's and Wrangler jeans and flannel shirts. And, so that just solidified for me that I was not a part of. And that sort of set the pace for the last 30 years. But I was 13, and according to state law, when you turn 14, you can choose which parent you want to live with. So when I turned 14, I immediately moved in with my dad so I could be back in the country. And my first experience with alcohol was not long after that. We were at skating rink. And that was before the iPad and phones and all that good stuff. So that's what you did on a Friday night. And it was a six-pack of Coors Light. And I absolutely hated the way that it tasted. But I loved the way it made me feel. You know, the book says we drink because we like the effect produced by alcohol. and I was no exception. And so from age of 14 to 17, I recreationally used everything, anything I could get my hands on. At the time, that wasn't much. It was like marijuana and cocaine, but those were the things that I did. And so I guess about the time I graduated from high school, I really started getting into cocaine and doing a lot of that. And for me, that made me okay. And I was accepted. And if I wasn't, I didn't care. after I graduated from high school, went straight to college. I met my husband, and we used together. We drank the same. We used the same. And so I thought it was a match made in heaven. And shortly after we got married, I guess about 6 months later, I found that I was pregnant. I stopped doing everything. I had the perfect pregnancy. And in August of 1988, I gave birth to a beautiful little girl. About a year later, the marriage was really kind of falling apart. My alcoholism was starting to really take hold. I was in complete denial that there was a problem. I lived for the weekends, but I held down a job. I did the things that we do that make us an adult. I didn't see a problem. And so after that divorce, very shortly after that divorce, I went to a party from old high school friends and ran into my old high school sweetheart. And he drank like I drank. He used like I used. So it was love at first sight all over again. And so 6 months later, you know, we're living together and we're pregnant. And the problem was I couldn't stop drinking. And I remember so vividly finding out I was pregnant in September of 1990 and thinking, well, I've got to stop. Okay, I'll stop next week. And 3 months pregnant, 4 months pregnant, I couldn't stop. I didn't stop. And despite the knowledge that what I was doing to my unborn child was probably very harmful, I simply could not stop. And fortunately, May the 4th of 1991, a little 5-pound boy was born. And he was healthy by the grace of God. But my use continued, and I drank, and I used anything and everything that I could get my hands on, and so did my husband. That relationship became very, 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 surprise, unhealthy, violent, abusive, and within about a year, that marriage was falling apart. So here I am, 26 years old, with two failed marriages and two children. My first husband realized that there was something seriously wrong. So he sued me for custody of my daughter and won. And my second husband, we're in the throes of sort of a divorce and separation and all that good stuff. He realizes now that the first husband's got the daughter, he's going to get my son. And he did. My mom was living in California at the time. She had remarried and moved to California. And so she started kind of understanding there was a problem, something wasn't right, and all the things I were telling her wasn't exactly truthful, because how do you lose two children and go through two divorces if everything's okay? So my mom, doing the only thing my mom knew how to do, started throwing money at it. Treatment. Well, before treatment, it was a house. Just don't use in the house. She bought me a house. Just don't use in the house. A car. She gave me a business. Manage it. This will be your, you know, this will be your legacy. Okay, Mom, okay, Mom, okay, Mom. Of course, I didn't hold up my end of the bargain at all. And so then she knew for sure that there was definitely a problem, and so then she started throwing money at treatment. So my first treatment attempt was at Betty Ford Center. And I completed Betty Ford, booked my first class ticket home, and because my ego, oh, my God, my ego, and I have a really bad relationship. But so I got on the plane, immediately ordered a drink because it was free. And it made sense to me at the time. And came home and immediately started doing what I'd always done and got what I always got. So then I went to Peachford and completed Peachford and was out of Peachford about 2 weeks. Went back right back to what I'd been doing. And so by this time, my mom has moved back to Atlanta. And she said, if you don't get it together, you're getting out of that house. Okay, Mom, okay, Mom, okay, Mom. And I couldn't do it. And so by this point, of course, there was no denying that I was completely and totally addicted, but I was absolutely unwilling to give it up. I had already lost my kids, so why not? To me, I had every excuse in the book to drink and use the way that I did, because if you had my childhood and if the things that happened to me had happened to you, you'd be strung out too. And I lived, oh man, did I ride that excuse for years. And so she threw me out of that house. And I hope I never know, but I cannot imagine what it must be like as a mom to throw your kid out in the street. And the rest of my family had said, you can't come here. And so I was in the street. I threw everything I owned in the car, everything that I could grab in my car. And I went to where people who use like me, I went to where they are, which happened to be Hollywood Road and Perry Boulevard. It's a great part of town. And that's where I spent the next 18 months. And I lied, and I cheated, and I scammed, and I ran game, and I conned, and I did what we do when we're out there. And that became normal. And I would give my mom a periodic phone call just to let her know that I was still alive, because I thought she might want to know. And that became my norm. And sleeping in abandoned houses and begging people for change and not eating, not sleeping. I mean, those things, you know, in and out of jail is perfectly normal to me. So finally, about, like I said, about 18 months, this guy that I was dating, and I managed to get into a boarding house. And he would control me with the drugs and alcohol, and that's how he got what he wanted. And I remember one night we had gotten into an incredibly heated fight, and I mean, it was incredibly physical, and it was ugly. And I curled up in a ball, and I started sobbing. And I said, God, I don't care what you do, but do something. If it's take me out of here, that's fine. If it's death, that's fine. Just get me out of here. 2 days later, I was in a girl's car. I was driving her car, dropped her off at Paces Ferry Road and 285, and I was coming back to get her. So I'm coming from Bankhead Highway to Paces Ferry Road on 285, going 95 miles an hour, about 9 o'clock at night, and I flew past the Cobb County police officer. So he'll say he pulled me over, and I'm right at the exit ramp to get on to get off at Paces Ferry. I've got a half a gallon bottle of vodka between my legs. I don't even know this girl's last name. I just know I've got her car. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm waiting for him to get out of the car. And I look in the rearview mirror, and I look at the exit ramp, and I think, I can outrun this guy. Just going to let him get out of the car, and I'm gone. And I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking, God, that would suck, though, if he caught me. You know, it would be really bad. And all of a sudden, this voice that I'm convinced was my God said, didn't you ask me for help? Didn't you ask me to help you? And I surrendered right then. And that was April 29th, 1998. And so he comes to the car, and I said, my name is Sharman Wilson. Here's my driver's license number. Here's my birth date. I don't know the girl's last name whose car this is. I don't have proof of registration. No, there's not insurance on the car, and I've obviously been drinking. And he's writing. Hey, just have a seat. Just stay right there. And so he goes back to the car, and I'm like, you know, I'm at peace. It's okay. I know what's about to happen. And he comes back to the car, step on out of the car, go back to the car. He said, you know, I'm not even going to do a sobriety test. He said, just blow. So I blew, 0.28. And he said, you know, between the DUI, the open container, no proof of insurance, no proof of registration, speeding, you could go to jail for a minute. Yes, I know. And he said, I'm not going to arrest you for any of that. And he said, but I do have to take you to jail because there's a warrant for you. And it was for violation of probation. So he took me to Smyrna, and they had a jail then. I don't know if they still do or not, but they had a jail back then. And I sat in jail for about a week and finally got in front of the judge. And they took us in three at a time. And it was just in, like, in a little conference room. It wasn't like a courtroom. And they took us in three at a time. The first girl goes, and he said, "You're charged with violation of probation. What do you have to say for yourself?" And she said, "I don't have a job. There was no way I could get here. I couldn't pay my fines. I blah, 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 blah." And he said, "You know what? You've got 90 days left on your probation. You can serve it in jail. Go." Second girl goes, "What do you have to say for yourself?" "Well, I don't have transportation, you know, blah, blah, BS, 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 blah, blah." "Well, you've got 6 months left on your probation. You can serve it in jail. Peace out." And I'm thinking, holy shit. I have no idea how much time I have left on probation, but I knew I didn't want to spend it in jail. And, you know, I really had. I had just surrendered, you know, and it was just like, just be honest. Wow, you know, a novel concept. Just be honest. And so he said, "What's your story?" You know, and I said, "You know what, I'm a drug addict and I'm an alcoholic and I need help." And about that time, a deputy walked in and handed him a drug screen. And he said, "We don't need that." And almost verbatim to what the cop had said that arrested me, he said, "You know, I don't think you need to go to jail. I think you need help." And he mandated me to treatment. Called my mom. She got a plane ticket. She said, "I'm going to get you out. I'm putting you straight on a plane. You're going to this treatment. You're staying as long as they tell you to stay. And if you leave early, I'll never speak to you again." That was May the 4th, 1998. That was my son's 7th birthday. And so I got on the plane, and I got sober. And that was the first real introduction I had to AA and what it was really all about. Betty Ford's great. Peace Ford's great. They serve a purpose. It's awesome. But the meat and potatoes and the way to live is in this book. And I had never really been shown the book. And I was there for 5 months, and I was shown the book. And I was taught what it meant to work the steps. I was taught what it meant to have a sponsor. I was taught what it meant, you know, to carry the message. And I was on fire for the program. I left there and decided to relocate to Rochester, Minnesota. That's where I went. And lived there for about 18 months. And the guy that I was dating at the time had family in Virginia. And so I wanted to come closer to my kids so I could drive to see my children, not have to take a flight, but I didn't want to be in Atlanta yet. I just didn't trust myself. So we moved to a little town called Radford, Virginia, and I started working at a place called St. Albans Psychiatric Hospital as a psych tech. The first day I started there, I met a lady named Rhonda, and she was an IOP therapist for their substance abuse program. And I don't know, she saw something in me. And she said, "Have you ever thought about getting your counseling license?" And I said, "Well, no." And she said, "Let me help you." And so for the next year, I went back to school and finished. She taught me everything she knew. She supervised me. She mothered me. She loved me. And a year later, in October of 2001, I sat for the counseling exam and passed. I came to Atlanta to celebrate and see my family, and my sister was way off the rails in her addiction at this time. The night before I got ready to leave to come go back to Virginia, no one knew where she was. She was missing and had been missing for weeks. So me, being the badass that I thought I was, tracked down the drug dealer, interrogated him, found out where my sister was, and drug her out of a really bad place. And took her to my parents' house. And the next day, I called my boyfriend. And I said, "There's been a change in plans. I'm not coming home today. My sister, blah, blah, blah." And just to show you how healthy I wasn't, his response to me was, "You better get your effing ass home right now." And I went, "F you." Click. And it was like something in me absolutely snapped. And I was done. You know, this guy was the exact same relationship I'd had for years before, just happened to be sober. Just as sick, just as controlling, just as abusive, just as nasty. And so I drove up there, grabbed everything I could get my hands on while he was at work, and took off and came back. Started working in a methadone clinic here in Atlanta, putting that counseling license to good work. And about 6 months later, I met my husband, and who would become my husband. Met him, and he introduced me to 8111. And we started going to meetings together, and like any good alcoholic, within 6 months, we were living together, pregnant, and planning a wedding. And so I can't believe my clients are here, and I'm saying this in front of them, because they're going to say, what about you? What about you? But that's what I did. And so, you know, and I was like, what, 3 or 4 years sober? You'd think I'd know better. But anyway, we didn't. So we got married in November of 2002. And my third child, my beautiful daughter, was born April the 18th, 2003. I got a fantastic job at Northside Hospital running their recovery residence. I managed that program for about 5 years, and all my dreams had come true. I had a house. I had a car. I was sober. I had the love and affection of my family and friends. I had all the stuff. I had a great job, and I did it well. And something started to happen the last year I worked at Northside. I stopped going to meetings so much. I had worked the steps. I had made amends. I went to meetings to give people chips. I called my sponsor when I wanted to. Maybe I'd call her on my birthday and have her come give me a chip because it looked good. You know, and I'm like 7, 8 years sober, 9 years sober maybe. And I really wasn't doing a whole lot for the program. And I'm an intensely spiritual person. And I now know, as I look back, that the only reason I stayed sober all of those years was not necessarily because I was in the middle of the bed of the program, but because I had a profound and deep love for the God of my understanding. And that God kept his hand on me until I took it off. So in 2007, after the birth of my fourth and final child, I left Northside and started my own program called Bridge to Recovery. And it was instantly successful. We went from 2 to 4 to 6 to 8 apartments inside of a year. We were very successful. And I loved it. And again, looking back, it's so easy to see how, as I started to step back from the program and stop doing the things that I had done the first 5, 6, 7 years of my recovery, problems started coming up. I started having problems in my marriage. People were getting on my nerves. I didn't want to be bothered. I was irritated all the time. All the agnostic promises were front and center in my life again. And it was all about me. And it's hard to admit, but, you know, by this point, I was 10 years sober. I got this thing, man. I'm running a recovery residence, dude. I got it going on. I was so stupid, full of myself. Yeah. But I did. I looked around and I thought, I've done okay. You know, and for year after year, what I failed to do was recognize that God had blessed me over and over and over again, despite myself. He continued to bless me. And something happened, and I took the focus off of what he had done for me and decided that I had done for me. Deadly mistake. So in 2007, when I was 8 months pregnant with my son, I had a head-on collision. And it really screwed my neck up. But I kind of lived with it, you know. Well, by 2010, my neck and shoulders were really starting to bother me. I go to the doctor. He does an MRI, and he said, yeah, you got a problem. You've got degenerative disc disease, and it's like 5, 6, and 7, and my neck and upper back were just basically shattered. He said, you're going to have surgery. And I said, I'm not having surgery. He said, you have to have surgery. I'm not having surgery. Well, you know, we can try some physical therapy and some pain medication, but you have to have surgery. Give me the pain medication. Give me the physical therapist number. Well, at this time, I'm drinking 4, 5, 6 cups of coffee between 6:30 in the morning and 12 o'clock in the afternoon, and then I'm stopping by the store and getting a 4-pack of Red Bull and killing that before the day is over. And so you couple that kind of caffeine addiction with pain medication, it alters your mood. It really does. And so for 6 months, that's how I lived. And to me, it was perfectly fine because I had legitimate pain and I'm going to work and I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing and I'm doing the deal. It's good. Everything's fine. I'm sober. I'm passed the drug test. And so needless to say, over that six-month period, somewhere between March of 2010 and August of 2010, things between my husband and I had gotten much, much worse. And we were fighting all the time. No wonder. He had stopped going to meetings. I had basically stopped going to meetings. And we reverted to what we knew, which was self-will. A disaster. So in August of 2010, I said, screw you, I've had enough, I'm moving out, I don't need you anyway. And I did. We shared custody of our children. And I continued to go to work, and everything looked fine. And finally, the pain medication didn't work anymore. And so my doctor said, you've got to have surgery. So in December 2010, I had surgery. I had a steel plate put in my neck. And he said, all right, we're going to wean you off these pain meds. I said, fine, that's great. So he discontinued the prescription. And in January, I had like the last couple of, you know, pain meds. And I started going into withdrawal. And I was like, what? What? I'd never taken medication in my life. I did the things that, I did the old school drugs. Never taken pain medication. So when I went into withdrawal, here I am, an addictions counselor, been sober a long time, heard thousands of people's story, and I'm surprised that I'm in withdrawal. It was just shocking to me, the level of denial that I was in and had been in for months. So I began the doctor shop. And by the end of February, they kind of figured out what was going on too. So March, I had basically burned all my bridges, you know, in the medical community. And one day, nothing out of the ordinary. Wasn't happy, wasn't sad. It was just another day. I was leaving Kohl's because that was the other thing I did. I shopped at my behavior. I acted out at my behavior. I raged at my behavior. I had emotionally relapsed months and months before. Pull out of this store, and I literally said out loud, and I'll bleep myself. I said, I just don't give a. I said it out loud. And I turned in the liquor store and bought half a gallon bottle of vodka and, hold on, wait for it, Kahlua. What the? Like, what was I going to have with my coffee then? I don't even know what that was about, but that's what I bought. I don't know. So I go to my apartment, and within 12 hours, I was right back to my drug choice. 12 hours. Inside of 5 months, I blew up my business, my marriage, my relationships with my family, my good standing in the community. There were a lot of people at 8111 that looked up to me, a lot of people, and I devastated their trust, their respect, and 24 clients left hanging in the lurch at Bridge to Recovery. And I lit it all on fire, and I didn't care. I remember someone saying at a meeting one time, and I thought, this guy is insane, but he had like 28 years sober, and I thought, and he said, there will come a time with the untreated alcoholic, if they do not work this program, they will be in so much pain they must drink. And I went, what? You always have a choice whether or not you drink. Not true. Not true for this alcoholic. I was in so much pain. I had shopped at it. I had sexed at it. I had acted out on it. I had spent money at it. I had done everything at it, that ism. And I still hurt. I felt like I had no option. So in May, I've been going at it about 2-3 months. In May, my mom said, I will pay for you to go to treatment if you'll go. And I said, fine, I'll go. So it's a beautiful place in Boca Raton, Florida. On the beach. I mean, you know, but that was fun, and it was fun. I met some wonderful, wonderful people who I still am in contact with today, but I knew I wasn't done. I knew it. A friend of mine told me one time, Charmin, the monkey doesn't care. What did he say? All the monkey knows is he's got the keys to the cage. Monkey don't know what he's going to do with the keys. All he knows is he's got the keys, and the monkey had my keys. I came back. I relapsed immediately. Finally, in August of 2011, I was driving down Holcomb Bridge Road, barely remember this, and ran off the road and blew out two tires on my car. Woke me up. It's a long story that really doesn't matter, but the police finally appeared. I didn't call them. But they finally appeared. And they ran my name, of course, and said, oh, you're coming with us. You've got a warrant. And I said, what? You got a warrant out of Cherokee County. Doctor shopping. Fraud. What? So they took me to Gwinnett County Jail. I sat there for about a week. Nobody wanted to hear from me. And oh, by the way, did I mention that that day was my daughter's 23rd birthday? So while my family was getting together on a Sunday afternoon like we always do with birthdays when we group them all together and celebrate holidays and birthdays, I was sitting in Gwinnett County Jail. Imagine my horror knowing that, man, my son's birthday is August 17th and her birthday is August 18th. So imagine my horror knowing that my family is together and I'm in jail. Cherokee County came and got me, took me up there, lovely place. And I knew because I'd been in jail enough that there's AA meetings in jail, so I went down to the AA meeting that they had there. And the ladies that bring the meeting to the inmates, you know, were sitting there, and she said, so are there any newcomers? That was my white chip. That was my surrender. My ego had been completely deflated. I had completely surrendered because, after all, I was Charmin Talley. I was an addictions counselor. I had it all, right? No, I was sitting in a fucking orange jumpsuit with about a week sober. That's what I was. And I had to make peace with what I was and what I had become. She gave me a big book. Go back to my cell. A girl that I'm sharing a cell with comes in and says, is that book for alcoholics? And I said, yep, it's the big book. Well, she was a habitual offender. She was there for a habitual offender DUI. And she said, yeah, I've heard about it. They told me I should go to some meetings when I get out of here, you know, whatever. And I got down off the cell and I said, why don't we read it together? And before I left there, we had gotten on our knees and done a third step prayer. We'd gone through the first 164 pages of the book, and she was working on her fourth step when I left. I had written a complete fourth step while I was there. And when I left, I immediately called the only man in the world that I trusted anymore at 8111. His name is Harold. He's 72 years old. He's got 21 years sober. And I said, will you sponsor me? Will you please sponsor me? But I don't know about the rest of you women, but I got female issues, and I couldn't talk to no female about some of the stuff that was on my four-step. And he said, yes, of course I'll sponsor you. So I met him in 8111 and went down to the basement, and I did my fifth step. I did 6 and 7 immediately. The next day I made a list, and I started making my amends. I didn't have anywhere to stay. Let me say this real quickly. When I got out of jail, I was there for 35 days, and when I got out, my daughter, my beautiful daughter, who I had worked so hard to regain her trust and her love and her friendship and her affection, since she was 10 years old, she had only known me sober, she picked me up. and I'm on fire, and I'm happy, and I'm out of jail, and it's a newfound freedom for real, and I'm just so excited, and I'm talking to her, and blah, 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 and she's very quiet. And there's a couple of you that know my daughter. She ain't quiet. And I finally said, what is the matter? And she said, Mom, I'm effing pissed. She said, I'm pissed at you. You let me down. You disappointed me. You destroyed my life. I barely got through nursing school because I was so worried about you. You didn't have the right to do this in my life. And you know, I had forgotten, because I was so wrapped up in myself, what my disease, what my addiction does to the people who love me. And she let me know. And I'm so grateful. I needed to hear what she had to say so that I could, you know, not just go skipping on my merry way, oh, I'm back. No, I needed to recognize that I had destroyed this young girl again. So I didn't have anywhere to go. So I called a guy who's got about 30 years sober from 8111, and I said, can I please stay in your basement? He said, yeah, but, you know, you're a newcomer. I'm going to have to watch you. I don't know. Kind of stay in your basement. Yeah, it's fine. Stayed with him about 30 or 45 days. Another girl that I know that's been sober about 12 or 13 years now. I said, can I please stay with you? Yes, you can stay with me. I stayed with her until she sold her house. My husband said, I filed for divorce, and I'm asking for sole custody of those kids. And I said, please wait. Please just wait. Nope. I'm done. By this time, we had been married 9 or 10 years, and I said, please just give me 90 days. Nope. I'm done. So I had about 90 days sober, I guess, and my mom helped me get a little apartment over in Sandy Springs at the residences at Morgan Falls. And I lived there, and I slept on the floor for the first couple of weeks. And Christmas time came around, and so just because of the holidays and the kids being out of school and my husband having to work and all that kind of stuff, he and I had to interact more than normal. And so I was spending a lot of time at my old home that I gave away, and we started talking. And what we realized is that we love each other very much, and that when we took those vows for sickness or health, we meant it. And he agreed to withdraw the divorce. And so I'm happy to say that the rest is history. In January, I moved back into my house. I've worked the steps. I continue to work the steps. 6 months after that would have been July of 2012. A friend of mine in the program had a small recovery residence that was for men only, and he said, Charmin, will you come help me turn this thing around? It's really kind of falling apart. And I said, I would love to. And so I started managing his little program, and, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't want to do something like Bridge again, but I knew that wasn't doing what I was doing for him, wasn't it? But it was my privilege and my honor to get to be back in my field and do what I love to do. And the fact that this man believed in me at 11 months sober to give me that shot, I was so humbled by that. And so about 6 months in, I walk every morning. And so I'm walking around the lake in my neighborhood. And I said, God, what do you want me to do? Just what do you want me to do? Please tell me what you want me to do, God. And I don't know about y'all, but God talks to me. He talks to me. And he said, you will have a program. It will not be a business. It will be a ministry. And it will be for women. And I said, I don't like women. I don't want to work with women. That's how I knew it was God, because I would have never come up with that by myself. And that's what happened. So about a month later, my husband and I opened Cornerstone Recovery Residences. And we opened them in the very apartment complex that I lived in for that short period of time. It is my privilege and honor to work with primarily women. I do have 4 male beds, but the rest of the beds are female. It is the light of my life to minister. And I don't say that in a religious sense. I say that in a humble, spiritual, AA service-oriented way to minister to these women and love them and encourage them and walk with them, not with force or ego or arrogance, but with love and compassion and genuine care and concern. And I'm doing exactly what I was meant to do. In the 12 and 12, chapter, step 6, at the end, one of my favorite lines in that book says, "Delay is dangerous and rebellion may be fatal." I'm so grateful that my rebellion wasn't fatal. I'm so grateful my rebellion wasn't fatal because I don't have the right to commit a slow form of suicide and punish my family any more than they've been punished. Like I said, I call my sponsor. I go to meetings. I work with other women, not just the women in my program. I sponsor women, and I give back. In the book, and I always share this anytime I'm asked to share, chapter 6, Into Action, it tells us, these are the action steps. It tells us, these are just a few things that it mentions. This requires action on our part. Next page, it says, we often find such a person quick to see and understand. Excuse me. When we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We pocket our pride and go to it. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit. We go, reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any length to find a spiritual experience. We ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. There is plenty we should do at home. We must take the lead. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. But we don't delay if it can be avoided. We don't delay. We vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. But we must go further, and that means more action. When we retire, we review. On awakening, we think. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, thy will be done. But this is not all. There is action and more action. And what I always say is, I'm either practicing the presence of God or I'm practicing the problem. And today I try to practice the presence of God, and when I do that, everything turns out fine. Thank you for letting me share my experience, strength, and hope.
Michelle? Okay. Charmin, thank you so much. Michelle's going to come up and hand out the chips.
Thank you, Tim. Good evening. My name is Michelle, and I am an alcoholic and an addict. Here in AA, we have the chip system to mark our time in sobriety. First chip is our white chip, surrender chip. If you would like to join our way of life, any more white chips? Surrender? Next, we have 30 days and 1,000 nights. Maybe that's for me. Next is 90. Thank you. Any more 90 days? 6 months? 6 months. Going twice. 9 months.
Wow.
One more time, 9 months. Years? Anyone with birthdays or that we don't know about? 1 year or multiple? We have a special birthday tonight. Oh, you do?
Hey, y'all, I'm Jackie. I'm an alcoholic. This is two. Thank you. Wow, it's really humbling to stand up here and pick up a two-year chip. I spent a lot of time this week thinking about where I was 2 years ago when I came into this program, and that was not a very happy place. And the transformation that I've gone through has just been completely amazing, and I am so grateful to this program, and I'm so grateful for good sponsorship direction, and I'm so grateful for the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and that I've just been given the opportunity to get into this program and take the actions, because that's what it takes, and that's what I did. And the biggest difference in my life today compared to my life 2 years ago is that I now have a God of my understanding, and before I never had that, and it's made all the difference in the world, because I now have a God that I can trust and rely on, and it's peaceful, and I'm grateful, and I just I thank all of you, because without you I couldn't have done this alone, so thank you.
Hey, I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. This is my good friend and your good friend, if you're an alcoholic, Tinsley. And it's an honor to give him a chip. And, you know, I could say about Tim and Tinsley, talk as long as longer than you could bear it about good things about them. But I heard when I came into AA, I asked an old timer, what's the difference? And he said, commitment. Commit yourself to something. And the longer I'm around, the more I understand that. And he can tell you what he does for a living. That's not my job. But Tinsley is a family man. He travels all over the country. He's very busy. He has a lot of commitments. And yet, he's always at this meeting when he's in town. He drags himself in when he's been driving all night. He sponsors people. He goes to other meetings pretty much every day. And the lesson for me is, if Tinsley Ellis can work with alcoholics, go to meetings every day, and be at meetings and put sobriety number one in his life, any of us can. And along with Tinsley and Tim, they started the coffee shops here that have been such a great entertainment venue. And all over the state, not just Atlanta, people come to those. But anyway, thank you for being in my life, helping me, and it's an honor to give you a 15-year chip.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And I need this program just as bad now as I needed it when I first came in here. And for different reasons, because life gets complicated. But life might get complicated, but it helps if I keep recovery simple. So I do five things. I go to a ton of meetings. I have a competent sponsor of my own gender. I work all 12 steps in order. I've learned to pray. And I do service work. So if there's any man in the room tonight that needs a sponsor, come see me after the meeting, and I'll take you through the steps. Thanks for my sobriety.
I'm still Tim, and this is Tim, my friend and yours also, if you're an alcoholic. And Tim is an amazing man, and I say that with a capital M. We met in this meeting 7 years ago, his first AA meeting. And it's just been unbelievable. I don't think there's not much left, Lord, hold it back if there is, that can happen to somebody their first 7 years that has not happened to Tim. Finances, serious health problems, just you name it, he's had it in bukus. But, you know, another thing I learned early on, people would say sobriety can't stand competition. And when Tim came in, that was it. And he is one person, I'm not a real pushy guy, but I've never had to push Tim. He's had to pull me. And he'll call me and I'll hang up and tell Connie, I don't know, but I couldn't do what he's doing, and I mean that. But anyway, we've got probably the biggest speaker meeting in town now, I guess one of them, and not to just pin laurels on him, because what he has and his love for people, we've got over about 250 speakers online now you can listen to. Not just here, he lives 50 miles away, and he's like the rest of us, just getting by, but he's always here. He's the first to get here, the last to leave. And it is an honor to be his friend and to give him his 7-year chip. So I love you.
Thank you, Tim, and thank you, everyone. And golly, I've been picking chips up all week. This will be the last one this week, I promise. Got the opportunity to pick one up at Thursday night. Tinsley shared his story over at We're Not a Glum Lot. And if you haven't heard Tinsley's story, you really need to go out and find him, and I hope we can have him back here soon. But he is on our website, so if you go looking back a couple of years, Tinsley E. But he was one of the first person that I heard tell their story here. I think I'd been sober a week or two, and I saw his name on the bulletin board that he was going to be telling his story. And I really thought that my life was over at that point. And that was like, wow. I was always a big fan of the man. And I cannot believe that I've had the good fortune to work this program with Tinsley. He's really an incredible guy. And everybody else. Tim Moore was here the very first time I walked in the door. And he said, man, we need you more than you need us. And I don't know if that was a trick, but it worked. He used reverse psychology on me. And about 2 weeks later, I called him and asked him if he'd be my sponsor. And he put me to work in here right away. So it's working so far. I'm still sober. Thank you, everybody.
Anyone want to pick up a white chip? Yeah. Anyone else? Well, congratulations to everyone who picked up chips and the birthdays we celebrate tonight and everyone else.
Okay, thank you everyone for joining us at the Blue Chip Speaker Meeting tonight. And finishing, we'll have a brief period for AA and